Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield, and I'm excited because tonight I happen to know that my wife is preparing some liver for dinner. And while liver may not be your thing per se, it's certainly mine, and I've got some antibiotic-free and non-added hormone beef liver that I'll be enjoying to get loaded up with a lot of vitamins and minerals and nutrients, pretty much most of what I'll need for the day. And I've been using a lot of kind of new sources of meat, such as liver, pemmican, and some other things that I am getting from a company called US Wellness Meats. And they're very unique, and I've got the mastermind farmer behind US Wellness Meats on the call with me today to talk about farming and how the method that farm animals are, or the method used to raise farm animals, can kind of dictate how healthy the food is that you put in your mouth. And we're also going to go beyond cattle, and we'll be talking a little bit today about some other things like honey and butter and even something called pemmican. So John is on the call with me today, lifelong farmer John Wood from U.S. Wellness Meats. John, how are you doing?
No, just great, Ben. Thank you very much for being on your program, and congratulations on the liver. And you're also getting about 25 enzymes in the liver that actually helps in some of your metabolic processes. And I think liver, if you go back to our Native Americans that were on this continent for centuries, I've got several friends that that are ancestry to those great Indian tribes, and they would harvest a deer, and the first thing they consumed was the liver, right out of the body of the animal. And the leader of the hunting party and the most senior member of the group got the first bite, and they would eat that liver just directly out of the body cavity. They knew how powerful those organ meats were, the liver and the spleen and thymus glands, and they had figured out over centuries that there's some real nutrition, especially, and they didn't have any way to store liver in those days. I mean, they had to consume it right on the spot. But it's interesting what our ancestors used to do to maintain proper health. There were no antibiotics, no trips to the doctor. You had to have a thriving immune system just to survive.
Yeah, and we didn't quite pull it right out of the cow and eat it, but my wife made it with some onions and bacon last week, and it tastes good if you prepare it right. I know some people may not care for the taste of liver, but I'm telling you, if you get your hands on a good liver recipe, it's good stuff. So, John, you do something different with the way that you raise your cattle and the way that you run your farm. What do you do, and why do you do what you do?
Well, my story is somewhat interesting. I came out of a fifth-generation family farm in northeast Missouri. I went off to college at Iowa State University, and I was trained to be a cattle feeder back in the early 1970s, and that was the dawn of the, diastabestrol, one of the first hormones given to animals, and one of the buildings I attended class in was paid for by that patent. And, I was, everyone thought it was a thing to do. Nobody knew any implications otherwise, and so I charged along for about 25 years, and then stumbled into some research. It's kind of a long story, but somewhere in the late 1990s, I became aware of some research out of the University of Wisconsin about Dr. Mike Pariza doing a PhD study on the possibility of cancer from charcoal broiling beef. That was kind of a concern back in the 1970s. And what he discovered, something in red meat was impeding the growth of the tumors he was trying to grow. And another year or two later, they discovered this double-bonded carbon molecule called conjugated linoleic acid, which is not what they intended to discover in this process. But CLA is produced by grass-fed dairy animals, grass-fed beef animals, lamb, bison, any animal with a four-chambered stomach. Humans don't produce it, pigs don't produce it, but chickens obviously don't produce it. But that kind of prompted our curiosity, and in order to do that, then this grass-fed meat movement was just in its infancy. It was a very common practice in Argentina, very common practice in parts of Australia, very common practice in parts of New Zealand. In fact, Argentinians led the world in per capita beef consumption, and they were far behind us in deaths per thousand from heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. So it makes one wonder just a little bit. And I think the facts are out now. We've been sadly told in the 1960s that fat was bad, and there were some terrible decisions made made by decision makers, and we starve ourselves on fats for 30 or 40 years, and we've just created a carbohydrate binge and sugar binge, and then we got the fallout from that all over the place. But basically, 1997, we harvested the first grass-fed animal, cherry-picked the very best animal out of a pasture, and took it to the local country locker. I told the butcher, I don't think it'll be fit for steaks. Let me know when you get the hide off the animal what you think you would do if it was your animal. And he called back and said, well, grade low choice. I says, oh, no, it can't grade low choice. Just impossible. Hadn't had a mouthful of grain. And I went over and looked at it, and I said, well, it is low choice. I can see that. I can't believe it. So go ahead and cut the usual steaks we have in the family order. And we got the animal back in about 10 days, 2 weeks, and had a little barbecue grill set up one night. And we compared that grass-fed animal. Three of us sat around the grill, three members of the company today, and we cooked it compared to a piece of prime Hereford beef. I mean, this was prime plus. Mm-hmm. And we all three said without question, the grass-fed's got a better flavor. No question about it. And we cut both of them with a plastic knife and a fork, and we just didn't believe it. We're from the Show Me State of Missouri, and we thought, well, this never happened again. And we went about our business for another year, and we did the same thing in 1998, and we had the same results, which kind of confounded us. I mean, I couldn't believe it happened 2 years in a row. In 1999, we harvested five or six animals, and we sent those off. And when we had them harvested this time, we actually collected tissue from them, and we checked for CLA and omega-3s, and the University of Illinois lab was able to do that, and the Iowa State University biochem lab. At that time, you couldn't even go to a commercial lab. They weren't set up to look for CLA. We were so far ahead of the curve, it wasn't even funny. Hmm. And then that winter, I guess, in December, January, those results came back and made the decision to resign from the family farm and chart a whole new course. And I had a piece of property I purchased from my parents and planted part of the farm to grass a year or two before, and that's where this whole thing started. But we were, so like I said, we were so far ahead of this movement, it wasn't even funny back in 1999 and 2000.
Wow. And you're not just doing any old thing with the cattle that you're raising. You're actually kind of using some different farming methods. Can you explain how it is that you're raising your cattle?
Well, basically, you know, grass-fed beef is nothing new to this planet. I mean, you go back 1.8 million years ago, and, you know, our hunter-gatherer ancestors were consuming the same thing. But what we do is a little bit unique. The buffalo did it to a certain extent. They would graze in one area and then move on. You know, they would only stay in a local area for a limited period of time. At that time, there were some predators around, and they would, overgraze. They would just graze in there. It may not come back for 2 years. Let's call managed grazing. And Mother Nature had a system for that. And on the farms that we manage, up until the mid-1950s, most of the beef consumed in the United States was grass-fed beef. My father tells me there would be an auction in Omaha every summer. The really fancy three-year-old steers would come off of the sandhill pastures in Nebraska, and the restaurateurs of New York City and Chicago would bid on those animals on a live basis in Omaha stockyards. It was a famous auction. And those days, you know, disappeared as we got into the grain feeding business. But what we do differently now, we can get those animals, you know, up to weight in two and a half years. It doesn't take 3 years. And we do, it's called managed intensive grazing. It was a term coined by the University of Missouri back in the 1980s. Dr. Jim Garish was kind of the pioneer, and Missouri was probably the forerunner in the entire country on managing grass. And basically, if you can imagine the room that you're placing this call in today, and you broke the floor up into 30 individual sections, each one represents one day of the month, and the cattle start off on day one. Let's say there's 4 acres and 100 animals, and day two they go to the second paddock, day three the third paddock. Well, you can imagine if you only mowed your yard once every 30 days, you'd have a lot of green grass, you know, and that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to give the grass plants a chance to rest, and by doing that, instead of, you know, cannibalizing their root systems in order to keep growing top growth that's being eaten off every day, they actually grow deeper and the roots go deeper. The water, now we soak up more of the rainfall that falls. The animals spread their manure around more uniformly. We're doing a better job of managing plant nutrients and the nutrients from the animals. And after 4 or 5 years, all of a sudden you wonder where all this grass came from. And we've improved the plant community. We've improved the biodiversity. Instead of having 2 or 3 species, now all of a sudden we've got 6 or 7 species of plants. Some of the old native plants that were wiped out in the 1800s, you see the blue stems and the switchgrasses and the Indian grasses starting to come back to life. And so you change the entire biodiversity of the landscape. And this is fun to watch. And in fact, Jim Garrish is in your great state of Idaho, in May, Idaho. He's practicing his trade there now as an independent consultant, but he does a lot of great work in the Intermountain regions of the western states.
So how come, if this is so good for the environment and better for the animals, I mean, why don't all farmers kind of use this method?
Well, number one, it takes more time, it takes more management, and, you know, it's there again, it's what drives your passion. You know, I'm passionate about land, I'm passionate about producing grass-fed beef. Most cow-calf operators, you know, the cows are part of their financial network of the business, but they put more emphasis on raising their crops. The cows go out to pasture, they don't really see them again until fall because, you know, you don't have to haul hay to them in the summertime, and so you can get by with the least amount of management. Well, by upping the management quotient, what we're trying to do, a handful is trying to produce grass-fed beef, where we're working twice as hard to get, you know, 2 or 3 times as hard because we're out there every day. You've got to build you have additional fencing requirements. It's a pretty simple fence to hold the animals. They get really smart. They see you coming on your little four-wheeler. They run up to the gate. They wait till you open the gate. They go in and put their head down. They'll chop away for 20 minutes, never even more to lift their heads up. So the animals are in a utopia. It's they're fresh grass every day. Just the way we manage them, they're much more content than the conventional situation. And sadly, in most pastures, they spend 90% of their time grazing on 10% of the pasture. They never walk very far away from the water source or the shade source. And by this method, we actually encourage those animals to utilize the entire landscape and far more nutrition.
So it's better for the landscape. It's more friendly for the animal. But how about when you dig into the nutrient profile of meat? You mentioned higher levels of conjugated linoleic acid, which has, I know, some great properties for everything from brain health to enhancing fat burning. But what else do you notice in the nutrient profile of an animal that is raised using this method?
Well, the most dramatic thing is, and also roll your clock back to 1900, you know, heart disease was hardly ever, it wasn't even really discussed in medical school until the 1910s or 20s. I mean, I think Mayo Clinic first talked about it in the 1920s. And prior to that point, you know, it was all grass-fed beef. Very little grain was ever fed to cattle. They ate too much, and the grain went to pigs and chickens. But what happens when you feed a bovine lots of grain, 20 to 25 pounds of corn a day, you dramatically increase the omega-6 profile, decrease the omega-3 profile. In the grazing animal, you have an omega-6 to 3 ratio of 2 to 1, 3 to 1. Fish and chicken are 3 or 4 to 1, and grain-fed beef is about 18 to 20 to 1. So you have a dramatic difference in omega-6s. And we work with a strongman athlete, John Anderson, who was kind of one of the top strongman athletes back in 2003 and 4. Now he's involved in WWE. But John told me after consuming 3 to 4 pounds of our beef a day for about 5 weeks, it wasn't how much stronger he felt back in 2003. He said, gee, Christmas, my elbows are better, my hands are better, my hips are better, knees are better. And of course, a guy like John Anderson, who's sitting there deadlifting, you know, 900 pounds and squatting 800 pounds 15 or 20 times, I mean, just the wear and tear. And so he immediately noticed the effect of the omega-3s. That's the most dramatic thing. And the doctor said for years, eat your fish and chicken. Well, the whole deal was slow down red meat and increase fish and chicken, the white meats, and to lower that omega-6 level. And so we all need some omega-6s, but we get way too many in the American diet. Mm-hmm. And then from an athletic perspective, the branched chain amino acids are higher. So if you're an athlete, a basketball player, you can jump higher, rebound higher. And baseball players ought to be able to. We've got a couple of pro baseball players, and one of them called me the other day or sent me a text an hour before game time. It was like last Friday. Well, I know if you should eat a pemmican bar. I said, my gosh, yes. I said your fly balls go 50 feet further, a little extra energy. But so, you know, the in real nutshell, in the bullet point form, omega-6-3 ratio dramatically better. The CLA ratio is much higher because there's very little CLA in grain-fed beef. There's a little bit the animal retains as a calf when it's on its mother, but by keeping these animals on grass for 200 days really raise CLA levels, where they are a significant contributor. Polyunsaturated, good for the heart, you know, fights cancer, fights diabetes, and helps take off fat and put on lean muscle. There was a trial in the winter of 1999-2000 at Iowa State where they fed some pigs hydrogenated safflower oil, which is a synthetic form of CLA. Well, the pigs had 25% less back fat and 10% larger loin eyes. So they were putting on less fat and putting on more muscle. And then the cattlemen's group saw the same thing, but there was no economical way to feed safflower oil. I mean, that we got in on kind of a free, our lab work was free that first time, because they were actually real excited to get some actual grass-fed samples to compare against their synthetic samples.
Right, right. Now, you have obviously expanded beyond beef, and I know that you've got some other things. And I'll link to U.S. Wellness Meats, by the way, for people listening and who want to kind of look at some of this stuff. But what other types of things are you now raising on your – well, I guess you've got more than one farm now, right?
That's correct. And after about 2003, we were having real troubles. And we were working on the marketing side, and we actually brought an outside consultant and said, you guys really need some marketing flankers. I'm thinking of football players, but marketing flankers. And so we added grass-fed butter, and we added free-range chickens, and we immediately noticed an uptick in sales. And we were real careful. We found a great company in Minnesota they were with us for about 7 years and actually went out of business tragically about 2 years ago. That was some of the best grass-fed butter in the world. We replaced it with some Kerrygold butter out of Ireland, which is 100% grass-fed butter. But the free-range chickens, we got a farmer in the Carolinas. He's retired president of the Organic Association there. I've been doing free-range chickens for 30 years, and so we've been able to surround ourselves with some people equally passionately involved. And we have an Oklahoma producer now that's the same makeup, can produce a lot of chickens for us. We get into grass-fed lamb, and that's a real niche. And we use hair sheep. These animals do not produce wool, so you don't have near the lanolin, and so it's really clean. In fact, I think grass-fed lamb loin chops are equal to beef tenderloin fillets. I mean, they're just exquisite in quality and flavor. So. And then the people are really after lean meat. They were after the bison, and we've been selling bison now for 7 years. And our primary supplier is an Indian reservation northeast of Rapid City, South Dakota. They still harvest the bison in the field. They bring a USDA abattoir to the field. It's a really clever way they do it. But, I mean, this is the way bison were harvested, for centuries. So mm-hmm. A pretty unique story. And we have a rabbit producer, producing rabbits on alfalfa hay, and it's a really clean product. The gentleman's retired, Russian analyst for the U.S. Army. We just surrounded ourselves with some really fun people, and by searching out people that are really that were doing the same thinking process, we were able to help their marketing out as we went along. But those are the primary proteins that we're dealing with.
If you're not a fan of beef, you've got some other options the rabbit and the lamb and obviously butter and you're doing cheese as well.
Yeah, we do about 10 different kinds of raw dairy cheese, which is just exquisite stuff. And this is made with raw and pasteurized milk, and it's got to be aged for 60 days where we can sell it. But if you're a cheese connoisseur, I guarantee you'll find something you really like.
Now, you age your cheese, and I know that makes it taste better. Is there any other reason that you're aging it?
Well, it's because in order to sell raw cheese, it's got to ferment for a minimum of 60 days for USDA to let you sell it. So this cheese goes into, the cheesemaker has a mold of cheese, and it's got to set at a certain temperature for 60 days, and then they come, USDA has a process for supervising that, but it's worked really, really well for us.
Now, you also age your meat, right?
That's one of our secrets. We learned that just kind of by dumb luck. We were with a company in 1999. The first animals we harvested through a connection at the University of Missouri called PM Beef, and they were the first company to really perfect wet aging. And that's where you harvest the animal on Monday. On Wednesday, you break the carcass into like 20 subprimal cuts, your flanks, your skirts, your briskets, your inside rounds, outside rounds, ribeye, tenderloins, strip loins. And those cuts go into a vacuum bag, and they set at 32, 33 degrees for a minimum of 30 days before we ever touch them. And by doing that, we even out the flavor profile. The enzymatic action there will actually tenderize the meat. We don't let it dry age, which is the centuries-old method, because dry aging, you evaporate 3 to 5% of the water out of the carcass in the process. And cooking meat, tenderness is moisture. You know, basically, it's real short and simple. You know, the better job you do at cooking, the more moisture you leave in the product. And by doing the wet aging, we've already left 5% more moisture in the product than you would have otherwise with the dry aging process. So that's been one of our secrets. And I've got a father who's 89 years of age. He'll let me know if it's not right. And, you know, he just raves about how tender this product. And we've got very, very few complaints about tough steaks. And that's just one thing we couldn't afford to have. So the aging process has really, really helped us on that.
Yeah, and you also have this other thing that I have a freezer full of now and am pretty much hooked on and addicted to. It's called pemmican. Can you explain exactly what pemmican is and how you guys are making it or what makes it unique and how somebody would use something like this?
We had a phone call from a fitness trainer in Syosset, New York, back in probably 2002, one of our early customers, and we knew everybody by name back in those days because, you know, we didn't have that many customers. And he was a student of the Russian strength coaches back in the 1920s and 30s. In fact, he was allowed to go to Russia and a handpicked group of people, 5 or 6 people, were allowed to go to Russia somewhere about that same time frame, and they got to meet some of these older coaches who were in their 80s and 90s. And interestingly enough, before the dawn of steroids and weight training, they figured out that pemmican, which was made by the folks in Siberia and made by our ancestors in this country, and before refrigeration, they would harvest buffalo in this country, and I don't know what sort of animals they harvested in Russia, yaks or whatever they were, and they would take the leanest muscle of the animal, and they would dry it, and they would turn it into jerky, and they would almost air dry it. It was like 10% moisture, and then any of the fat that came off around the kidneys and the organs and around the underside of the hide, they would actually put that over a fire, and they would reduce all the water out of it and take the impurities out of it. And then they had pure tallow, and they had, you know, pure dried jerky, and they would usually add maybe some dried cherries or some raw honey. Both of those are antibacterial, and they would make this patty called pemmican. And you can Google pemmican, P-E-M-M-I-C-A-N, and you'll see a number of recipes from around the world. But the beauty of it is very high protein and very high fat. Well, it's a paleo food extraordinaire for the paleo movement. And the pemmican that we make is about 45% tallow and about 55% jerky. And we've kind of restructured the pemmican bars now, a little smaller model. They're 2.14 ounces, or you can buy it in a 2-pound tub. But the pemmican is just, you know, the perfect paleo food. You know, there's no garbage in it. It comes 3 different ways. We make one model with 2% raw honey and 3% dried cherry, and then we make in Celtic sea salt. And then we have another model. We take the honey and the cherry out, leave the sea salt in, and then the third model is no salt, no honey, and no cherry. There's a pretty dramatic flavor difference there when you take the salt out. But it's one of our most wildly popular items, and pemmican is a unique food. Either you like it or you don't like it. Some people that don't really care for it will actually add some raw honey to it when they consume it. But I'll have probably 3 pemmican bars a day on the average.
How many calories are in one of those pemmican bars? I'm just curious, because I stay full for so long after I eat one.
It is, if it's a 2.14 ounce bar, you know, there is about 1 ounce of tallow, or 0.96 ounces of tallow, and the balance of it's going to be dry jerky. So very, very dry jerky. So it's very high protein, very high fat, and there's just a slight amount of carbohydrate. The fat gives you a very, very slight bump on the carbohydrate chart, but you consume 1 or 2 of those for breakfast, and you're not hungry again until 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a great snack to take to the office.
Yeah, I've even chopped one up in some scrambled eggs before, and that really tops me off. So, so you've got pemmican, and by the way, for those of you folks listening in whose mouths are just watering right now, we'll put a discount for you. I'll give it to you right now, and we'll give it to you again at the end of the show. But if you go to US Wellness Meats, or you just follow the link that I have there in the show notes for you, you can use the discount code or the promo code GREENFILLED, and that'll give you a 15% off discount for pretty much anything you order, as long as it's under 40 pounds and it's not one of their, you know, their on sale type of items. But that's code GREENFILLED, and we'll put a link in the show notes. Now, John, you also have some other things. You've got condiments, you know, things like seasoning salts and barbecue sauces. Are you making these yourself, or are you guys kind of like sourcing them somewhere, or what's the deal with the condiments, and why would someone want to use something like this?
Basically, the barbecue sauce, we made that ourselves, and we had a shredded beef product that we were looking at, and a lot of people sell a shredded beef and like a pulled pork with the sauce in it, and we couldn't find a sauce that met our specs. We didn't want any high fructose corn syrup. We didn't want any MSG, and there's 100 ways to hide MSG in barbecue sauce, if you may not be aware of it, but that's probably every commercial sauce has probably got it in there. And we wanted it, you know, we wanted it really clean, and so, and we wanted it to taste good. And after 3 months of trial and error with a sauce maker up in North Dakota who makes all of Annie's barbecue sauce. So first of all, I had to find a sauce maker that was interested in doing something that was healthy. And that was a little bit of a struggle. But anyway, this company we've been using now for about 7 years, 6 or 7 years, the sauce is quite a hit. We actually have it in a shredded beef. It's one of our heat and serve products. And if you got kids in the household, you can warm it up and serve it in about 15 minutes. It's really, really simple. And we sell the sauce by itself, and we're selling lots of sauce, way more than we ever used to. But once you try it, you're kind of hooked on it. But it's it actually passes the natural specs from the standpoint of a natural label. There's a little bit of sugar cane. They call it organic succotent, which is like the first piece of sugar off the sugar cane. It's an unrefined, the real raw form of it, and then there's raw honey in it as well. So the barbecue sauce has been a lot of fun. The seasoning salt, we did a trade show in St. Louis, 6 or 7 years ago, and there was a guy that came up to me, and he said, "I want you to try my seasoning salt." I said, yeah, everyone's got a seasoning salt. Well, I come to find out this guy's mother, who at that time was actually deceased, she was extremely sensitive to chemicals. She was a super sensitive person. And you know, she was having, you know, this gentleman was about my age. So back in the 1950s, she developed her own, it was called My House Salt. And she made it herself, had coarse salt. She had 5 herbs, and there was no oils, no binders, no garbage. And this stuff works on fish, works on chicken, works on beef, works on lamb. I mean, it's just, I've tried a lot of sauces, a lot of dry rubs, but this is really, really good stuff. And that's another unique story. And then her sons actually got a little older, and then they started selling it to some local people wanted it, so they gave some to their friends, and then they actually started, you know, got it in a couple of grocery stores around St. Louis back in the 1980s, and now they slowly kind of grown that thing, and it's a really, really unique product. And then we've got an olive oil that we've actually sourced from California. The trees are 200 years of age. It's a really unique old olive that's been in California. Like the trees, like, for example, 200 years of age. And I assume the Spaniards or somebody brought those in years and years ago. The raw honey, we have a raw honey producer here in not too far from where we work out of here in northeast Missouri. And it's real raw, unfiltered honey, and you know, it's really, really good stuff. We've had a lot of people rave about the honey. So
nice. Yeah, this stuff is. I mean, it's so fun to just to order some of this stuff and taste it. I mean, everything's just different. You can definitely taste the difference when you try it. And I think a lot of folks aren't really aware that, you know, not all salt is created equal, and not all honey is created equal, and not all barbecue sauce is created equal. And there are some important considerations when you're trying to take care of your body and make sure that you get good nutrients into it without actually doing any damage with, you know, preservatives and artificial flavorings and things of that nature. Now, our pets are also important, and you guys have pet food. And I gotta tell you, I haven't used your pet food because for our pets, my wife just literally makes pet food in the blender with a bunch of beef and kale and minerals and stuff like that. But, you know, if somebody wanted to actually order pet food and not make a big mess in their kitchen, what do you guys have in your pet food?
We have a pet burger, which we do, like all the beef hearts and beef liver, all the trimmings that comes off the heart and liver goes into this pet burger product. That's about 5 to 10%, you know, beef heart and beef liver trim. And the balance of it, it's probably 75 to 80% lean, and it's just ground beef. And we put a pet label sticker on it just so you don't get it mixed up with the rest of your ground beef. Plus, with the organ meats, you can't mix those together anyway for human consumption. But we did that years ago and never thought of it. We had a few people ask us about it, and we haven't gone to the trouble to make a really complicated recipe. But I've got about 105-pound yellow lab who's just thrived on it, and in fact, he broke a leg when he was about 6 months of age. He had a rear leg that he fell out of back of my pickup, tragically, one Sunday afternoon at a really low speed. But anyway, a bad fracture, and the vet says, I can't really splint that. And there's a specialist, and he wanted $3,000. And I pinned the dog up, and I gave him marrow bones that we have. We have center cut marrow bones, and we actually have another company called US Cell Wellness, and I gave him some CalMag out of there, which is a really unique calcium magnesium supplement that's made off a crystal, and it's two parts magnesium, one part calcium. And the primary driver was just a pound or two of a pet burger a day. Mm-hmm. And after about 2 weeks, he was putting weight on the leg, and after about 4 weeks, he got out of his pen one day, and 6 weeks later, you couldn't tell he'd ever heard a thing. I mean, it was the darndest thing I ever saw. And I took him back for an x-ray, a couple of months later, and the vet says, whatever you do, don't tell anybody about this. It's kind of bad for my business, because most people would have probably put the dog down. I mean, it was a bad break. It was a candy cane fracture, and he's 4 years of age now, and you can't ever tell he ever had a broken leg. But it gets back to the power of really good food. And he was gobbling. He was eating about a pound of marrow bones a day. The bone marrow is really powerful stuff, and we make a marrow bone broth if you don't want to cook out your bones yourself, or we sell them. We have a really difficult time keeping in stock on marrow bones. The people with the GAPS, people on the GAPS diet have just gone kind of nuts over those bones.
But pets are the ability to make the bone broth out of them for healing the gut.
Exactly. And then that dog, I mean, I'll feed him marrow bones about once every 2 weeks now, or every 3 weeks. He'll get a nice big bone. But if you give him too many bones, he'll just be his hair just like brand new money now. I mean, it's amazing how the hair coat will shine up on it. And he's 100% raw diet. He has zero processed foods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all this stuff is fabulous. I like your guys' website that you can actually you can get any of this stuff there. Now of course I know I'll get the comments from people in the show notes that you need to support your local agriculture and support your local farm. And folks, I'm certainly not saying that that's not the case. We, for example, we do buy a local half of a cow here in Spokane, Washington, where my wife and I live, and we, we get our eggs and our milk from a CSA. But there are a lot of people that listen in that don't have access to that stuff, I know. And for you, being able to just order this stuff, like pemmican and raw honey and grass-fed dairy that's actually healthy without the antibiotics and the hormones, and grassland poultry and lamb and wild-caught seafood, these are things that can be hard to get, and there is a little bit of convenience to being able to point and click. But the goal with today's podcast was to make you aware of this US Wellness Meats, and also to kind of educate you on the fact that not all farms are running their operations the same way. Again, John graciously offered for anybody listening in to get a 15% discount with the code GREENFIELD over at US Wellness Meats, and I'll be sure to put the link and everything in the show notes as well. John, anything else you want to share with the audience?
No, yes, Ben, a couple things. We started off on liver, and we commented about that everybody likes liver. We actually have a couple of organ sausages. One's called Braunschweiger, which is 35% liver and 55% or 65% ground beef. And, a lot of people don't like liver, rave about the Braunschweiger. If you didn't tell them it was in there, they wouldn't know it. I mean, it's a really good flavor. We put just a touch of raw honey in that to sweeten it up a little bit. So if you're not really a liver junkie like some of us are, the Braunschweiger is a great choice. And we have another organ sausage called Liverwurst, which will be restocked here early next week. But it's got, you know, kidney and heart and liver. It's about 50% organ meats and 50% ground beef. But those are easy ways, and most kids love young children who really haven't had any. They're young and naive, and I've been enough trade shows. I've rarely ever seen a child that didn't like liverwurst or like braunschweiger. As we get older, we have these preconceived ideas on what's good and what's bad. But those are, in fact, one of our good customers had a pair of daughters, twin daughters, born three months premature at 18 months of age. They're well above normal height and weight. And those kids have never consumed standard baby food. They've eaten grass-fed beef heart, grass-fed beef liver. The father is a really true pioneer in the paleo movement, and those kids have been raised on a paleo diet. But it's just amazing. I have a number of people I know that have made, we have several customers have lost 100 pounds by just switching the meat they eat. We have athletes that have gone from a 540-pound deadlift in April of 2010, by November of 2010, they're doing a 720-pound deadlift. They've never used a steroid, and the main change is just changing the meat. They go from Costco, you know, whatever the cheapest hamburger is at Sam's or wherever they buy it, and they're putting this grass-fed ground beef in the diet full of CLA and omega-3s, and it's just really fun to watch this stuff take place.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. And of course, folks, if you're listening in, you probably are going to want to grab yourself a chest freezer. That's what I did. That's where all my pemmican is stocked right now. So anyways, though, John, thank you so much for coming on and kind of educating us about this stuff.
It's been my pleasure, Ben, and I appreciate you taking time to spread the good news, because, you know, our whole mission in this endeavor is education, education, and education. And, you know, it's just, you know, we're having to reteach ourselves things that my great-great-grandfather, great-great-grandmother took for granted. I mean, they knew all this stuff. You go back for four and five generations, because they had to be healthy. There were no antibiotics to protect the infection from a blister. There were no antibiotics to protect from a sore throat. And what drove them to eat well was the fact that they had to eat well to have a well-tuned autoimmune system. And I think that's a real weak link we have in this world today.
Yeah. Well, folks, it's U.S. Wellness Meats. You can check out the show notes for this episode over at bengreenfieldfitness.com. And the 15% discount you can use at U.S. Wellness Meats is Greenfield. And John, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. Have a super year. Very good.